fishing. I'm going fishing. Hook, sinker, and line.
Oh, man, I love that song.
Said, fish.
You know, it was 1971. Elvin Bishop did that album, and that's Charlie Daniels playing fiddle on it. Give me just a little bit more there, RJ. A little bit more. Before Charlie Daniels became Charlie Daniels, he was playing fiddle for Elvin Bishop. So when you're hearing that, that's Charlie Daniels playing the fiddle on that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where, you know, you don't know. We're going to play more of that in a little while, just so you can hear it, because we all know Charlie Daniels, you know, the devil went to Georgia and all that, but it's hard to imagine, and the song is not available anywhere in the U.S. The last time it was published was in early 1980s. It was a big hit in Japan. Yeah, it was a big hit in Japan.
Well, I tell you, the Japanese love fishing. Fishing and golf. Most people think they just play golf. They play golf, then they go fishing.
It's, you know, and I, in my travels around the world and everything else, I've known a lot of Japanese people are just awesome, and they do love to fish. But it never made any money in the U.S., that song. But in Japan, they did real good with it in Japan. So, anyway, Fish and Frank here, RJ, our producer over there, and Robert in the chair across from me. Good afternoon, Robert.
Good afternoon, Frank.
We be here, you be there. It's a lot of UB stuff here today. All right. We got a lot of fishing going on out there. I guess everybody's talking about shark and tarpon.
Yeah.
But I went out Sunday. A few years ago, I bought a pontoon boat for my mom and dad. Had a rail welded to the front of it so that, you know, mom could lean against the rail. Bolted it through the front of the boat. Had it all welded up nice. And they've used that because mom can't step up and down to get over on a boat. And with this boat, it's a fiberglass pontoon boat. Just walks off the dock onto the boat. There's no steps up and down, and she can use her little walker thing to get out there. And we went to go out, and I keep telling my dad, you can't buy ethanol gas for the boat. Well, he doesn't want to pay that extra buck for the non-ethanol. And he says, I've talked to Yamaha, and they said it runs on ethanol. Well, everybody needs to know, a motor that runs on ethanol is only different than a regular motor by the hoses and some of the components inside. Ethanol is very corrosive and very destructive to most materials. So they build the motors with the right materials to run on ethanol, but that only means it runs on ethanol. It doesn't mean you can let it sit with ethanol in it. If ethanol gas sits in Yamaha motors, the four strokes, have a vacuum chamber ahead of the fuel injection system. And that ethanol gets in there and just turns to jelly. And a lot of times they will let just enough through so the boat will idle. But as soon as you go to push more throttle on it, it'll just choke off. And it boop, 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 boop. You go back to an idle, it runs again. And usually that means your vacuum chamber is pretty much gummed up with a bunch of jelly ethanol. And we took the boat out Sunday because he wanted to get mom out on the water. So we went out and made it right in front of the house, out the canal out in front of the house, and boop, 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 boop. It wouldn't run. Went back, changed the water separator, thought, well, there's always a chance it's that. But when I took it off, I saw the gas was pretty clear in it. I said, that ain't going to do it. So it turned out the vacuum chamber, because it missed the ethanol in that vacuum chamber. It turns it into, from a liquid into a gas. And that's when it's particularly bad. It'll separate in your fuel tank. You got to put the additives in it to keep it from separating. It's a real problem in boats, and it's much cheaper to pay the extra buck for the gas. So anyway, we go out, we anchor up, say, well, what the heck, we're already out here, might as well just anchor here on the Peace River. Start catching a whole bunch of catfish. And catfish are fun. I don't care what anybody says, your first, you're out there fishing, and all of a sudden the rod bends over, and you're fighting, and you're pulling, and the next thing you know, you're like, I don't know, what is it, what is it? Is it a redfish? What is that? And then the rod goes bump, 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 bump. You're like, it's a catfish. Right?
Oh, absolutely. We all do that.
Yeah, I mean, but that first few seconds, until you know what you have, it's awesome. And then you find out what you got, you get all deflated.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not one of those. But anyway, we were trying to fish for sharks. Because I know there's usually always a few little sharks up there in the Peace River, especially this time of year. So going through catfish after catfish, and all of a sudden the rod just bends over, and the drag's pulling, and all of a sudden I'm watching out the front of the boat, and I see this streak going across left to right about 4 feet under the water, and all I can see is grays and kind of whites, and I'm like, man, you got a little black tip on there. It turned out to be the biggest catfish I think I've ever seen, almost 30 inches long. I couldn't even get my gripper around it.
That's a giant sail cat.
It was amazing. And I'm trying to get my gripper around it because I always carry the grippers. I don't even know.
Fish grip.
Fish gripper, yeah. It's got two metal jaws on it. And you squeeze the handle and it grabs a catfish and you never get stung. It was so big, it literally fell out of my gripper. I couldn't hold it. And it sliced the end of my index finger. Second catfish to ever get me. And I have bleach, and I put a little hydrogen peroxide, a little bleach on it, and went away. And you never put bleach on an open cut. It's very bad for you. Now, I do it whenever I get stuck by a fish, because saltwater bacteria likes alcohol almost as much as I do. And it doesn't do anything but make the saltwater bacteria happy. Putting alcohol on it does no good. But I put bleach on it, and bleach kills everything, including you if you're not careful. So, anyway, we let that catfish go. We actually took a couple pictures of it. And then all of a sudden, everything stopped biting. No catfish. Now, it's been, what, 8 years, 10 years since I did a charter?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. It was a long time. We've been concentrating on working in the store. Robert and I have been building the business up, getting it going. It's where it is now because Robert and I just dedicated everything to making that store go. And so I forgot, when I was doing charters out there, I put my chum bags out, and I use that, I'm lazy, so I use the chum that's already in the bag.
Right.
And I put off the boat, I drop my anchor, I put one out that has just the normal chum scent, and then on the other side, I put one that has the anise oil in it, that licorice scent. And so I drop my anchor first, then I immediately put my chum stuff out. Then I throw a line out with a bobber, feed a bunch of line out of it, and it's usually 4 feet under a bobber, 3.5, 4 feet, chunk of bait on it. And what I'm doing with that is seeing what direction the current's actually flowing. Put my rod tip down to the water, and I watch where the bobber ends up, because that's going to tell me the direction of current. And when you're sitting in a boat or standing in a boat, you can't tell really which way the current's going, because if the current's going straight away from the back of the boat and the wind is blowing a little off from the left, it actually looks like the current's going more that way. You have the apparent, you know, current and where the boat's affected by the current and the wind. A bobber on a line with your rod tip in the water is only affected by the current. So you can tell where your chum's going to go. So once I'm satisfied my chum's going in the right way, put that rod in a holder, throw another one out free line, and then I put a couple out with sinkers. Well, we were just had some out. We were using half sardine at a time, which catfish really love, and so do the sharks. But we're catching catfish after catfish after catfish, and then all of a sudden, they quit. And I forgot, because I've done 100 or 200 or 400 of those charters, you know, going through 40, 50, 80 catfish, and then all of a sudden, they quit. And then, ba-dum, 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 right? Two notes that are scary as anything. And the sharks move in. And they move all the catfish off. It's kind of like when you're catching little sharks and the little sharks stop biting. You know the big
shark moved in.
That's it. The big sharks have come. Well, I forgot that when the sharks come in, the catfish leave. And I'm looking at my dad going, hey, Dad, I think maybe we're going to have to move. I mean, everything quit. All of a sudden, the rod just takes off screaming. And It's going good. It's big. There's no stopping it. Got a 4,000 reel on a medium heavy 10 to 20 pound class rod. And my sister's grandson. Now, can you believe? Wait till you get to the day where it's not your sister and her kid. It's your sister and her grandson on the boat. And he's 18.
Uh-oh. How does that make you feel?
I mean, RJ, I don't think you're... You look younger than I am. I don't know. Maybe we're about the same age, but you look younger than I do. Do you have siblings?
I do. I haven't talked to them in years. So.
Okay, but you know, can you imagine, you know, you go out with your sibling, brother, sister, whatever, and they're not bringing their kids, they're bringing their grandkids?
Yep, that's how you know it's old.
Yeah, like, man, I don't even know what to call a kid. Anyway, his name's Jess. All right, so... He's on the rod, and it's just going, and I'm looking, going, okay, we're not going to stop this. So I go back. He's got half a spool of line left. So I go back, pull the anchor up. I could have just threw it over. I had a buoy on it, but I knew I had time. Grab the anchor, get it in the boat, and all of a sudden, I'm watching. I see him pulling on the rod. Pull it, pull it. And I'm looking at the crab trap out there about, 100 yards out from the boat, and every time he pulls, the crab trap ball goes. Dad, get on the throttle. We go over there. We get up there, unwrap the line from around the crab trap. He made about 2-3 turns around it and got the line off. I'm holding the line up real ginger with my hand, get it up over the rail on the front of the boat, and okay, go ahead, get him. And he starts pulling, and I look about 75 feet over, another crab trap. Every time he pulls, the ball in the crab trap moves. So we go over there, unwrap around the next one, and luckily I had 30-pound braid on there, and... It was no problem. The crab trap balls didn't have, you know, sometimes the line gets a lot of barnacles on it.
Oh, yeah. And this, real bad.
These were real soft lines. There was no barnacles, a little kind of slime funk on it. But I was surprised no barnacles on the line.
Yeah, that's really out of character.
So we get it off that one. He goes over. Eventually, we end up landing the fish. Dad's doing a great job backing the boat around. You got to keep that line out in front of the boat. And I'm pointing right, left. Okay, we got to back up. And we landed about a 4 or 5 foot bull shark. 10 to 20 pound class spinning rod. This is a snook rod, by the way, guys. We were literally fishing with that rod to catfish. We had a bigger rod out. But, of course...
Smaller rod's always going to get hit.
Yeah. The big rod with the big bait on it. Did the bull shark hit that? No. So, anyway, had a good time, and we're never more than 3 minutes from the house.
Nice.
So, but if you're out there and you got your chum bags out and you're getting catfish after catfish, make sure you got a gripper, a pair of pliers. But when they stop, great idea to start putting some big baits out, you know, or at least heavier rods, because that's when the sharks are going to show up. And then you're going to go through 2-3-4 foot sharks, and they're great on that light spinning tackle. But if they stop biting, now it's time to make sure you got 50, 60, 80-pound test, you know, 25, 30-pound top-end line class, because now you got big sharks coming.
Yes.
It's going to be. So we got to get out. We got to pick a day next week, and we're taking my boat and going fishing, RJ. The three of us are going to go. All right? So... We got to look at your board, figure out what day you've got off, and I will take the day off. So, anyway, that was my story, and...
That's a pretty good way to go into the shark fishing, because, I mean, you know, this time of year, everyone says that the sharks show up to eat the tarpon. And, yes, that's partially true, but the biggest thing that people forget about with the sharks... Our sharks.
What
are,
did I forget now, Robert?
Well, no.
Come on. You
not,
can tell me.
Not you.
Let's face it. Old timers has set in. I've forgotten. Go ahead. Tell me what I forgot.
It's a lot of the guys. Cause we've done several talks this week, and they all mentioned about the sharks come here to eat the tarpon. They don't come here to eat, just to eat the tarpon. The sharks show up this time of year for the main number one reason of birth. The same reason why the tarpon are here is to spawn.
Ta-da! Birth. The feeling of life.
Exactly.
It's... Na-na.
Exactly. Well, your sharks are live birth. All these other fish are egg layers.
Well, I'm glad they're not dead birth.
Well, some people think that sharks lay eggs. And certain rays do. And some really? Skates lay eggs.
I didn't know skates and rays laid eggs.
Some of them do. Not any in our area that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right. Because I was like, really, man, the old timers just set in. I'm thinking, I know the cobia like following the stingrays around and all that because it's like, excuse me for this, but it's like a giant Pez dispenser. Yeah. The little baby rays come out and the cobia and that just following behind them because it's very tasty little stuff.
Yeah, they just tap on it and it spits one out for them.
Yeah.
No. There's even some sharks that lay eggs, too, okay. But the biggest thing is that they come here to give birth. And they come here to give birth for two major reasons. One, all the small bait fish are here, so there's an abundance of food for the small sharks to feed on. But the other thing is, we're a natural estuary with tons of mangrove shorelines, with lots of shallow sandbars, with deeper pockets, where the little sharks can get to both feed, but to also escape the larger sharks that will eat them. Because sharks are cannibalistic.
The only major predator of small sharks is big sharks.
Exactly. You know, so a lot of people get confused and think that's the only reason why they're here. The big sharks just feed on the tarpon because that's another food source for them that is here also. And they got to replenish themselves after giving birth because the primary pupping season for sharks is April and May and even sometimes into June depending on the species.
Yeah, I keep no sharks in May. There's not one shark that I will take home to eat or do anything in May because 8 to 9 chance out of 10, that shark has babies.
Yeah, doesn't matter if it's a small bonnet head or an 8-foot bull shark. If it's a female, there's a very good chance she's got babies.
Yeah, I don't keep any sharks during May because it's just wrong. If they've made it all the way through May and they haven't been caught and killed and they get to this time, let them have the babies. And that gives us 2, 3, 4 more for next year. Now, catch and release and bending the barbs down. I hate circle hooks on shark because I can't get them out. I have to carry a bolt cutter and literally cut the circle hook out of the shark. And so I use J-hooks, but I pinch the barb down. And I roll that barb as much to leave as much height to the flattened out barb as I can. So it's more of a bump there. So I try and get right on the end of the barb and start working that down to kind of keep it curled instead of just crushing it flat. I want to roll it. Now, the nice part about it is once that barb's down and there's nothing to hold it, even if you cut the leader close to the shark, that hook is going to fall out very quickly. Yeah. It's no different than having a stingray barb in them or anything else, except it's easier for them to get out. So even if I've got to cut the leader, they can drop that hook.
Yeah, they'll work it out real quick.
If the barb's in there, that hook is going to stay in to fester, can cause blood poisoning, a lot of deterioration, rot, and all that. So you don't want to use barbs on your shark hooks. And I avoid the circle hooks because I'm there attending my rods. I'm not one of these guys leaving the rod out there and waiting for the shark to gobble it up, eat it, digest it, and wait for it to start coming out the other end before I get on the rod. I'm on the rod right away. And two types of bites with sharks. One is if they hit it going fast. Now, what I do then is I set the hook almost immediately. But if they're just kind of picking it up and going along with it, I don't set the hook yet. I grab the rod and I hold it, and I wait for them to stop or pause for just a second. And that means they're turning it in their mouth. If they grab it and they just kind of go along lazily with it, they didn't actually bite it to swallow it. They've got it in their mouth, they're trying to decide what to do with it. Then if they pause, they've decided to swallow it. That's as soon as they go again, that's when I get up on them. But it's kind of a hard thing to learn what the speed is.
Yeah, that's just practice and time.
Yeah, you've literally got to kind of, you know, go through the trial and error, miss a few fish, and then you'll kind of get it. But when they go hard and fast, that means usually they're in competition for the food. There's two sharks or more down there. There could be a dozen. And when they grab it and go like heck, that means some other shark is trying to eat it. So they're grabbing it, and they're going to get it, and that's their food, and they're already trying to swallow it. I set up on them right away.
Oh, that's a good idea. And it doesn't matter what size shark it is. If they're running like that, they're definitely inhaled it.
Right, and it's usually a competition thing because we always think of sharks as, okay, I'm gonna grab this and I'm gonna eat it. I'm gonna take a big bite out of it. But the reality is sometimes they just kind of grab it in their mouth and they're just kind of meandering around with it and they haven't decided if they're really hungry enough to eat it or what they're going to do with it. But it was there, so they picked it up.
Yeah.
And especially a bigger bait.
Yeah, definitely.
Little smaller bait, no, I'm kind of getting up on them right away because no matter what they got in their mouth. But if I've got a bigger bait out there looking for a bigger fish, like a whole 3-pound mullet or a couple of pound jack or a 3-pound jack, the whole bait, I'm not setting up on them right away when they go slow.
Right. No, I agree with that. You know, the only time I do that is if I know that bait was sitting right on the bottom, I usually get on them right away.
Okay.
And that's just because, you know, you're talking about putting one out under a bobber, one free line, and then one on a sinker. The thing that I have found personally with my experience when I'm anchored up with a bait sitting right on the bottom, mostly with larger sharks. The littler sharks, they're a little tricky to figure out sometimes. But if I've got a whole bonito or jack out there and that fish just starts to slowly, lazily swim away with it, I'm usually getting down on them right now rather than waiting, because I found that those bigger sharks, whether it's a lemon or a bull or a hammer for that matter, picking up that bait off the bottom when it's sitting still, a lot of times they don't just grab it and take off running with it. They actually come up and just kind of mouth it and swallow it right there on the spot and then start to swim away. I've had a couple of lemon sharks over the years where it's like you thought he picked it up and it was just slowly swimming away with it, and I was waiting for him to slow down to stop to do that turn and didn't. And have that hook be in the back of their throat or just get bit off because they actually swallowed it past the leader. You know, and I've had a couple other fish of unknowns that have done that. So I've learned that if it's sitting right on the bottom, I'm hammering them pretty quickly versus suspended baits or under a bobber. They tend to come up and grab it and keep on with their momentum versus
right.
That sit on the bottom. They just kind of come up, check it out, maybe mouth it, swallow it, and then they slowly swim off.
Okay, so the best idea is, until you really get into this, get on them right away. Now, RJ, are you a shark guy?
I do. I used to love shark fishing. And I also used to, like I said before, like to dive with the sharks.
Right.
And
now,
go ahead.
Where did you do your shark fishing? Was it down here, on the East Coast?
I'm from New England, so I've done a lot of blue shark fishing, mako shark fishing, caught a white once.
Really?
Yep.
All right, now, in your experience, when you were out there shark fishing, what did you do when the bite happened? Were you a setup arm right away guy? Were you a weight guy? What did you do?
Well, I'm like you. I hate the circle hooks. Use the J hooks, like you say, knock the barb down. But I get on them right away because what we used to see in the open ocean, you know, when you're fishing out in the open ocean as opposed to in the shallow water, there's usually heavy competition with sharks. There's usually very few sharks that are out there by themselves. So they are fighting over what they can get their mouth on. So they grab it and they go. And most hits in the Atlantic is the shark will take off like a submarine. He'll hit that bait and he'll just keep on going. And you don't have to worry about setting the hook.
I wish
they
you could see this,
you.
Folks. He's sitting over there, and he started talking, and he's kind of like, and then all of a sudden, you can see the corners of his mouth coming up.
Yeah.
He's starting to smile a little
bit. Yeah, the memories are coming back.
Yeah, all of a sudden, yeah, I'm getting back here. I remember this. This was great. Yeah.
But I'll go along with what Robert said. In Bermuda, when you would dive in Bermuda, you know, there would be these groups that would take the inexperienced divers out, take them in the shallow water 30, 40 feet, and they have big chunks of fish in these wire baskets, and they toss them up into the, and the sharks would come swim by grabbing the fish and stuff like that. And what you would see is a shark would grab it because of the competition, and he would get away from the rest of the sharks, and then you'd see him start eating. So, and we'd see a lot of that because we'd stay back, because if you want to get bit by a shark, get in the middle where they're going nuts trying to grab things, which I never understood why the tour guides did that, but they do it. But when you get further away, you see the sharks do it. They grab it, get away from their buddies, and then they'll eat it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of what we've been saying more or less all through this.
Yeah.
On a quick side note, Spanish mackerel are a real good indicator of sharks being in that area.
Yes.
because everything loves to eat Spanish mackerel. Now, you have to be very careful. Florida has special rules about using Spanish mackerel as bait. So you need to check on those rules, and basically it's got to be legal size, got to be whole condition, and you're not allowed to cut it up into chunks or anything else, no more than you are a snook. So be very careful using Spanish mackerel for bait, but they're one of the great indicators of sharks in the harbor. And we're hearing stories about some Spanish mackerel up by Marker 2, Marker 1, the 41 Bridge, not much at the Alligator Creek Reef, but literally from Cape Hayes all the way up the Intercoastal at this point, and a little bit of schools out in the Gulf. Yeah. Now, if you can find the Spanish mackerel, what do you think your odds are? How would you go about it, Robert, of getting sharks to hit while you're around a school of mackerel?
Usually I'm going to pull up upwind or up current from them and do a drift with a bait. I'm going to have just two baits out, one free line, one free line and one under a bobber, and try to drift right along the edge or right through the area where they're free jumping or going nuts at. Because there's almost always, you never know what size shark's going to be mixed in there with them.
My thing is, if the Spanish mackerel there, there's usually bait fish there. And so the Spanish mackerel are trying to eat the bait fish. The sharks are trying to eat the Spanish mackerel. What I like to do is throw a topwater. Now, for me, the best one is the large skitter walk. I like doing the large skitter walk, and if I'm trying to emulate a Spanish mackerel, I use one of the big offshore topwater lures, and I'll work it real heavy right through the school of Spanish mackerel, bait fish, something bigger that the Spanish mackerel aren't going to eat, but the sharks might. If I'm not, I'm using a full-size Zaraspook or a full-size skitter walk. The skitter walk holds together better. This Zaraspook I get a lot of hits on, but the sharks tend to rip them in half. They tear the head off of the Zaraspook, unless it's one of the saltwater versions. But a standard spook, you get a lot of hits on it, but you end up missing the whole back of the lure. You got the head left on it, any of the freshwater versions or standard versions. But with the skitter walk, they'll stay together good, and they'll hold up, and you can actually land the sharks on topwaters. But it's hard, fast, just like the bait's going. If the bait's jumping and working real hard, work the topwater hard. If the bait's not going real hard, but you're still seeing it, slow down the skitter walk. And splash, 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 stop. Splash, 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 stop. But if you got a lot of bait going, it's just boom, 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 splash, 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 splash. Really work that topwater. And it's an amazing thing getting a shark to hit a topwater. And sometimes they'll actually come up and backflip for you. But I love doing topwaters on sharks around the Spanish mackerel because, it's the little fish, they're eating the plankton, the Spanish mackerel eating the little fish, and then the sharks trying to eat the mackerel. And it's just a very cool experience to be through all that.
Well, it's a National Geographic moment a lot of times, what you're seeing. It's stuff you just literally, Blue Planet kind of material. I mean, there's some really, really neat things to witness out there.
So if you were going to go right now, Robert, where would you want to go for, let's say, 4-foot sharks?
I'm going to concentrate around the Cape Hayes area. The Cape Hayes, Cape Hayes Reef, even over to Marker 6 out in front of Burnt Store. That little imaginary line from Cape Hayes to Burnt Store, I like that spot a lot because it does draw in a lot of Spanish mackerel. A lot of little bait fish are usually in that whole area consistently, so I know I got a good chance.
Now, I'm going to use a chunk of bait about half the size of my fist. What bait are you looking for? Now, we're looking for 4-foot under sharks. What are you looking at?
A piece probably about the size of a golf ball or a tangerine.
There you
about
go.
Half your fist, basically. Not anything real big. And if I get hit by a big shark, he railed me and big deal. I'm concentrating on finding the smaller shark just to have fun with.
All right, well, let's flip it up. If you're going to go 8-foot shark right now, and you want an 8-foot shark, where are you going?
Honestly, I'm going to probably still be close to the Cape Hayes area, working anywhere from Cape Hayes all the way out through Boca Grande, even to some of the offshore reefs.
Now, the one difference that I do is when I'm looking for a bigger shark during the day, I'm going to go deep of waters I can find in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty good bet. Usually if I'm fishing in that Cape Hayes to Boca Grande area, I'm usually starting my fishing in like 12 feet of water. But I'm still there again. I'm still going to be looking for the bait. That Spanish mackerel is going to be what I'm looking for, whether it's Spanish mackerel, jacks, or even as you go through the pass, I'm looking for the Spanish mackerel, jacks, or bonita. You know, I'm looking for the feeding activity that's going on and trying to find those fish that way, because I like to drift a lot for sharks.
Now, RJ, when you were fishing sharks up there, obviously you're in deep water in the Atlantic, so you were drifting, right?
Yeah.
And
drifting or trolling.
Drifting, really?
Some of the bigger sharks will follow a bigger boat, you know, because you got a lot of boats coming in and out that are commercial fishermen, and they're cleaning their fishes, they're coming in and they're throwing the things out, so the sharks have learned to follow the boat. So trolling was usually a good way to do it.
While you were trolling, what kind of bait did you have out? Was it like a whole fish or pieces?
Yeah,
or?
Usually a whole fish, but a smaller whole fish, you know, maybe 8-10 inches long, hooked through the head. A lot of the captains would run the hook up through the top mouth of the fish, and the hook would come out through the top of the head, and that kept the bait on the hook longer than if you tried to hook them through the lower jaw or through the side. And the big sharks, they swallow. I mean, they're not taking a bite out of a fish that size. They're sucking it down. So, you know, it's going in their mouth. I don't think I've ever seen just a head come back with the hook on it.
So, now, I know Robert likes to use about 2.5 to 2 foot of steel leader and then heavy monofilament.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's absolutely accurate. I'm a firm believer in just a shorter leader for multiple reasons.
All right. When you guys were up there, how much steel leader did you have on that? 2 foot?
No, 6 foot? Probably 6 foot. Sometimes you'd see 8 foot if you're going after the bigger sharks in really deep water. A lot of the ocean-going sharks, you know, they're what they call the dentins on their side that make them really rough. That'll do a fine job on monofilament and even Dacron, and it's just rubbing up along their side as they're swimming along. You end up with this big frayed piece of Dacron when you get it back. So the longer leader is important because you want it to at least get past those fins in the back.
All right, so now one of the things, if you're going to do long leaders out there, boys and girls, most of us don't do that with the sharks in Southwest Florida because we don't have that much problem with it. But if you're going to go really 8 foot as long a leader as you can do without putting a swivel in it, even a lot of times when I'm doing an 8, I want to put a ball bearing swivel in the between from the hook. I come up about 4 to 6 foot and I'll put a ball bearing swivel there. And then attach the rest of the leader up another 4 to 6 foot and put another ball bearing swivel. Sharks like to roll, sharks like to spin, they go left, they go right. And when you have that real long leader, if you have that ball bearing in between it, it will actually function properly. The longer that leader is, the more steel you got out there, the more likely it is to twist up, become a mess with trying to get that shark up. But by putting ball bearing swivels, not swivels, swivels don't swivel under pressure. Ball bearing swivels do, and the American Fishing Wire ball bearing swivels are really good for that because they're $3 to $4 a pack versus $10 to $12 a pack for most of the high end ones. But it's the only inexpensive ball bearing swivel that actually works. Now, Robert, you're coming off, if you're going to fish 8 foot bull sharks, hook leader and finish leader.
Correct. Yeah, I'm usually using, let's say my main line is 60 or 80 pound mono, and then I'm tapering it up to 100 or 150 pound mono leader, and that's going to be anywhere from 10 to 30 feet long, and then I'm using about 18 inches of cable or piano wire for my leader itself.
Now, one of the reasons I like to do that, you know, put my hook and then go a couple feet of steel, and then I attached a very heavy mono, is not even so much for wearing through or protecting me from the shark breaking off. It's so I can grab it with my hands.
Yeah.
If all you've got is like braided line or thin line and steel to grab onto, that's pretty rough on you. But monofilament, bigger monofilament's a lot easier on your hands when you're trying to pull a fish up or control the fish. And so I'm a big one for the heavy mono just for my fingers.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. I mean, it's safer for you, and I mean, then it's also easier to control that fish next to the boat, so you can either cut the hook loose or flat out just pop the hook out. It just gives you much, much better control and safety issues. Because, I mean, number one and foremost with shark fishing, your safety is the most important part. You want to come back with all
of Well, my your... safety is. I don't know about you. I'm kind of one of those things where I don't have to outrun the lion. I just have to outrun you.
Yeah. You just want to come back with all your digits and not necessarily have a lot of scars to have to brag about.
Yeah, chicks dig scars. Uh-huh. They must really like me. Okay. Anyway, I guess one of the cooler things to go on a kind of the similar topic but a different topic is sight fishing right now. The harbor's very clear. The rains haven't started yet. They're going to start any time. If you can get out now before we get any serious rains, sight fishing. This is something they do all over the world, and we have very limited opportunities here because of the rain and the wind get the water all cloudy. But right now, wow. Get yeah. out, drift the east side bar, the west side bar, get out in the Gulf of Mexico.
Even get along the intercoastal. I mean, along the intercoastal right now is absolutely beautiful. There's places out there right now you actually can see 18 feet down to the bottom.
Really?
Yeah.
18?
Yeah.
All right.
Guys are telling me about, and I've seen it before personally, but I haven't seen it this year, but right there on the hill inside the pass, just as you meet the intercoastal, you're seeing the tarpon literally hugging the bottom. You're seeing cobia that are coming in through the passes, hugging the bottom. Some of the big Atlantic stingrays that are coming in and swimming around through there, you're able to see them all the way down to the bottom. It's impressive. I mean, I know personally off of my dock in a canal in Port Charlotte, I can see 3 feet down, no problem off my dock.
Yeah, that's why I was mistaking that catfish for a shark the other day. Because even up in Harbor Heights on the Peace River, I can see 4 or 5 feet down into the water.
Yep.
And it's unheard of. I love drifting the sandbars, even along the beaches right now. If you don't have a boat, go out along the beach. You got Middle Beach, you got Stump Pass, you got out off of Gasparilla Island.
Venice.
Go out Venice. You go off even down the north end of Sanibel where you've got Redfish Pass going through and all that. Mm-hmm. If you get out there now and go out in about knee-deep water, maybe just a little bit deeper, but not much, and if there's nobody around there, just take your fishing rod and start throwing a little spoon or something, just walking along. But don't concentrate on the fishing part of it. Literally watch in the water, and you're going to see snook going through your legs. You're going to see all these creatures and critters and stuff you never really get to see. And it's just amazing. I don't even know. I think I would just hold the rod with the lure at the ready until I saw something I wanted to cast at.
Yeah.
And that's the basis of sight fishing. You know, actually seeing the fish, casting at them, hooking up, and that's a lot of fun. I've done it for bonefish in the Keys. I've done it with freshwater trout. I've done it out in the Gulf, you know, all over the place. But sight fishing is one of the most cool things you can do because you see them, you cast to them, you hook up, you land them, and it's the entire thing. Not only do you get to have all the feel and all that, but you literally get to see the whole thing happen.
Absolutely.
And humans are very visual. That's why TV is popular, videos. I mean,
yeah, we're definitely visually stimulated the most as far as gaining knowledge.
So yeah. What I like to do along the intercoastal, if there's not a lot of boat traffic, if there's boat traffic, I'm going to get out to the outside of the intercoastal, find somewhere with about 3 feet of water, turn the motor off, and just let the wind or the current. Have a big hat on, shade your eyes. Now, sunglasses, match the color of your lens to the color of the water to do this. When you hold up, don't look at the front of the glasses. Turn the glasses out, and as you hold them up, look at the side where you see from, the side that are by your face, not the front of them, because the front of them can have green mirrors and blue mirrors and whatever they are. They don't. That doesn't tell you anything. That's fashion, not function. But the backside where you look through, when you hold them up to the light, there's blue, there's green, there's brown, there's grays, there's all different colors of those. Figure out what the color of the water is. Now, brown water, brown lenses work better. Blue-green water, blue-green lenses. And if you match your lens to the color of the water, you're going to see the most fish possible. Sorry. Still getting over this whole thing. I can't seem to shake it. But what you're looking for is to learn, it's like learning another language, like trying to read German or something. You have to understand what all these little symbols mean.
Yeah.
And you get to see a little bit of a flash, a line, something that goes on. When you're sight fishing, I always tell people, you're going along a sandbar drifting and you can see the sandbar. And then you see these dark shapes in the water. And most of the time, it's patches of grass.
Yeah.
Dark grass on that white sand bottom. And you're trying to distinguish between a patch of grass. When you got a little bit of waves, it looks like that patch of grass is wiggling. It really does. And as you're drifting, you can get the illusion, you know, like if you're sitting still in a train and another train goes by you, you have the feeling that you're moving. And so it kind of looks like that grass is moving, kind of looks like it's wiggling, but what you're looking for is something that looks like a patch of grass, but is actually a fish. And it's hard to discern the two, and I would rather go up and cast to 100 patches of imaginary fish grass than miss that one cobia or shark or tarpon because I said, nah, that was a patch of grass, then all of a sudden I see the tail or something.
As it swims by you.
As it's swimming off. Because yeah. I didn't want to be embarrassed and cast on another piece of grass.
Absolutely.
I have no ego. I am willing to embarrass myself 50 times in order to accomplish that one goal. Well, it's kind of like being a muskie fisherman. You're going to cast 50, 60, 80 times. And then you'll get it figured out.
The other benefit you have of the really clear water this time of year, whether you're a wade fisherman or in a boat, you get to learn the bottom and the contours so you know what to areas to figure out, so when the water does start to get darker, you can come back to these areas and say, okay, well, I use this for my landmark, or I marked it on my GPS, depending on how it is, to know that this is a little depression or a little trough or a sand hole or even a sand mound, an oyster patch. This is where some big patches of grass are at. You know, it allows you to really mentally map out what you've always kind of wanted to know about that area that you're fishing. And this is the most awesome time of year. I mean, I was just telling you 15 years ago when you took me down to Pine Island Sound about this time of year, we didn't even really fish. We just idled around so you could teach me some of Pine Island Sound because that place has the most obscure contour of anything in our area because it goes from 1 foot to 10 foot to 2 foot to 1 foot to 10 foot in seconds. There's oyster patches 100 yards away from the nearest mangrove shoreline.
Literally, you're going along, and you got this beautiful grass, and then all of a sudden, for no reason, there's a 10-foot hole there.
Yeah.
And then once you get across the hole, you're back into 12, 18 inches of water, and you've got this beautiful grass again, and then all of a sudden, you look over by an island, and the sand comes out, but it doesn't look quite right. And you go over there, and there's a 10, 15-foot hole.
Yeah.
And you look in the bottom, you can see the fish laying in the bottom of that hole. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's just, it's one of the most neatest things to really get to experience. So that way, when you come back to it for future spots, you have hopefully memorized even just a couple of spots. You don't have to memorize everything you've seen because it's not going to happen. But
we'll go to the Alligator Creek Reef. If the wind lays down, you've got some time where it's really calm. Right now, the water's clear enough. You can see the concrete. You can see the structure.
You can actually see the shadows of it from a quarter mile away.
So you're out there and you just literally turn the boat off and just drift along or leave the boat idling. But don't use the rod. Don't worry about, you know, make sure you're not going to run into anything. But literally stop and look and see the stuff. And that way when you go back and fish, you have an idea what you're fishing rather than just being blind about the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and plus it also, you know, for the people out there, because some of these fish finders are just terrifying with what you get to see on them, but a lot of people haven't gotten to those yet. There's still people that have some of the older fish finders. Now you can actually...
Including me. I don't have one.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can look at your fish finder and then physically look and see, okay, that's what I'm seeing, and this is what I'm seeing on my fish finder. So for future spots that you go to, you can say, hey, that looks similar to that other spot. That's probably what the contour actually looks like here. It actually gives you something to reference to firsthand.
Now, sight fishing out in the Gulf, that sounds to me like permit, cobia, maybe even amberjack, because the water's really clear now.
Oh, yeah, you should be able to see, I mean, realistically, it wouldn't surprise me if you could see 30, 40 feet down. I mean, I think right now, because of past experiences, this time of year, I've been able to see from a good quarter to a half a mile away, and my eyes suck.
Yeah, you're a little blind, but...
I can see the shadow of the Palm Island Ferry as we're approaching it.
Yeah. No, I love being out at Palm Island Ferry, because that's a gorgeous big ferry. It turned upside down. It landed. It's got 10 feet of relief underneath it. I mean, the bow of that boat sticks off the bottom like 10 foot, and it's a really cool reef out there. Which reefs would you go to for permit right now? Barracuda, stuff like that?
Any of them that are man-made. Any of the man-made reefs right now is going to be my shot. The problem with permit is that today they'll be at Novak Reef, tomorrow they'll be at the Trembly Reef, the next day they're up at the Palm Island Ferry, the next day they're at M11 off of Venice. You never really know where they're going to be. So, but the one thing that is consistent with permit for the most part on the west coast of Florida is that they really love to choose man-made structures rather than natural structures more than anything. Not saying you won't catch them on natural reefs, but more often than not, they like those structures.
Well, they like wrecks and man-made reefs because they stick up higher. And for some reason or another, permit like to be able to go around stuff and over stuff. And with rocks, it's usually not as high.
Yeah.
And the taller the object is, that's why the Palm Island Ferry holds different stuff out there all the time, because it sticks up off the bottom quite a ways.
Absolutely.
It was almost too shallow.
The more relief you have off the bottom.
Touch and go there.
The more relief you have off the bottom, the better the chances are that the permit are there.
That's why the Bay Ronto, the Pegasus, and a lot of people go to the Bay Ronto for the amberjack and permit and all that. Because it's a big boat. I mean, it's a big ship laying on the bottom, so it's tall.
Yep.
And fish like that height, and I'm not really sure why, but I know they do.
I don't know. Probably the same reason why they like the oil rigs so much. There's just a lot of... There's like probably a lot more surface area, basically, what it boils down to for all life to exist. You know, you take a smooth rock versus a rock that's very coarse and textured of the same size... It has a lot more biological life to it than the smooth rock does, because there's a lot more cracks and crevices, a lot more surface area technically.
My brain must have a lot of life in it, because it's got a lot of cracks and crevices. I'm pretty sure that. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, Robert and I will vouch for that.
All right. I'm going to say, you know, looking out, Spanish mackerel is a good one. Snook fishing is pretty good right now, but it's a little weird. I went up into Rocky Creek because March and April is my time. I go into Rocky Creek, a lot of big snook moving in and out of there. I was a week late. I thought, well, heck, it's only a week into May. I should still get some. Literally one fish blew up, cast in it, hooked him up, lost him in a matter of seconds. That was one kid that never really fished much. And he's standing there, and this big fish blows up. Jumps with his, comes out of the water, and I'm like, you can reel anytime you'd like to, turn the handle, you know, okay, walk backwards, just walk back. And he's standing there, eyes as big as saucers, and the fish has jumped once, come up, shook his head, now it's dove down, and it's heading right into the mangroves. And I'm like, you need to either reel or walk backwards. You do have to do something at this point. I mean, you cannot stand... Hello, move. He was just, oh my God, you know.
That
was
his first experience. We've all done that.
So, anyway, the snook wrapped the mangrove line. We lost that. But it was surprising. One fish, and there was nothing else up in there. It's amazing how a week can make a difference. You're either there when they're there, or you blew it. And I thought, maybe I'll get lucky. Not so much. But I didn't have a lot of time. I think one of the amazing things was I saw a little bait fish flip when I was going past the bridge, turned around, made one cast, and it wasn't particularly good. I mean, I didn't pancake the net. I just kind of got it open out of my 10-foot net. I'll bet you it was a 6-foot circle. But it dropped right next to the piling, got it up. There was so much bait fish in it, I could not lift the net into the boat. I dumped half it in the water and started dumping some on the deck. And when I got a pile, I tried to get the rest of it back in the water. And literally, I've got my grandnephew scooping bait into the live well, and I'm literally taking handfuls and throwing it back in the water before it dies. Right. Mixture of thread fins and greenbacks. But I love my live well. It 99% of everything lived till we got to the spot we were going. And so that was awesome. I don't use a pressure spray on the top. I just have hoses coming in the bottom that just dump volume of water, and then they're diverted onto the side, but under no pressure at all. And it boils all the scales and all the fish up towards the surface where they go out of the drains. I don't know that it's very effective having a high pressure spray going in at the top and then the drains at the top.
No, I don't understand that either.
So you're churning up the surface of the water, but you're not really getting the bottom, you know, cleared. So mine are, I drilled holes in the bottom of my live well, and I just brought the lines in, and the water goes out to both sides, and it just swirls up, and even all the scales and everything else go right out through the drains at the top. Works really good, but it's something I did. The factories never do that. All right, let's see what else we got going on here. We talked about bottom features. Trout is really coming on this week. What's up? It's awfully late in the year for the trout. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I don't know what that is about. I mean, honestly, every year it seems like there's a little point where it's starting to go into that summertime mode, and all of a sudden trout kind of turn on for a little window of opportunity. There's not great numbers out there, but I'm hearing reports literally from Pine Island Sound all the way up to Venice, but more reports basically from Boca Grande up through Venice area. Lemon Bay, the guys are catching anywhere from 8 to 12 trout, but they're all in that 20 to 24, even a couple 26-inch fish. I mean, good quality, good-sized trout. So I don't have a real good explanation for it other than to take advantage of it, because, you know, you're not going to catch good numbers. But, hey, you know, I'll take 2 or 3 20-plus-inch trout over a dozen 14-inch trout on the same tackle.
All right. Now, I'm in with that. Do you think, I mean, we do keep some trout all year, mm-hmm. and they are growing, and trout grow very quickly. So you think it's just leftovers from last winter? You think a new batch moved in?
Well, I think it's probably just leftover population. I think they're just moving around a lot, and I think those fish start to move out to a little bit deeper water. There's even a point where in June, you'll hear of schools of them out off the beaches for a couple of days.
Right. All right. Well, we'll get back to it. Let's see. Tuesday, we can't go fishing. Nope. Sunday afternoon is a possibility.
Going Wednesday, though.
Wednesday, we can go?
No, Wednesday, I'm going.
Oh, you're going. Oh, yeah, it's your birthday, isn't it?
I already got the day off. I'm sorry.
Okay. So
wait, you give him days off?
Once
how
in a
did
while.
That happen?
It's
once
probably the only job in the world where you say, well, I got a chance to go fishing today. I need the day off. All right, you know.
Yeah.
How can you be a fishing store and not give people off when they go fishing?
Yeah.
And it's Robert's birthday.
Happy birthday, Robert.
Well, thanks.
Well, next Thursday we'll have the birthday party. All right, Fish and Frank here. Robert in a chair across from me. And our producer and guidance counselor, RJ, in the chair up there. And I guess we're going to catch you all next week. Remember, fishandfranks.com for all kinds of fishing information. F-I-S-H-I-N, Franks.
I'm going fish, 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 fish.